we built this in 2015, and it wasn't until 2024 when a pre-dawn FBI raid was conducted on my premises with 50 armed FBI agents, drones, armored vehicles, guns drawn, you know, the whole nine yards, that I had any indication that there was a problem with what I was doing. The government claims that just by creating this software, knowing that it was possible for criminals to use the software, made me guilty for the crimes of those criminals.
Hi, I'm John Kiriakou, and welcome back to Deep Focus. A lot of you know that I spent 2.5 years in a federal prison for blowing the whistle on the CIA's torture program. I would do it again today if I had the opportunity and if there was a necessity for it. One of the things that I like about Donald Trump is that in many ways, he seems to be out there looking for wrongs to right. We may not all agree with him on all of these wrongs he's trying to right. We may actually not even see some of them as wrongs, but no president in American history has used the power of the pardon and the commutation as much as Donald Trump has. That is because he recognizes that the Justice Department, in many cases, is simply out of control. Think of it this way. Justice Department prosecutors don't get promoted by not prosecuting you. They don't get promoted for not going after you. They don't get promoted by not asking for the longest possible sentence. And all of them imagine themselves one day serving in Congress or as governor or as the U.S. attorney or in some corner office of a big city law firm making millions and millions of dollars a year. And they're going to do it on your back. There's a book that came out 10 or 12 years ago called Three Felonies a Day, written by Professor Harvey Silverglate. He's a professor of law at Harvard University. And he argues that we Americans are so over-criminalized, so over-regulated, that on the average day, the average American man or woman going about his or her normal business commits three felonies every single day. With the lesson being, if they want to get you, they're going to get you. And there's almost nothing you can do to protect yourself. Some of us fight. Our next guest fought. He's a computer expert. He's an expert in Bitcoin and these digital currencies now, and he's an expert in privacy. He set something up called Samurai, which was a privacy wallet related to Bitcoin, right? Is it anybody's business if we own Bitcoin or buy Bitcoin or sell Bitcoin? I don't think it is. But the government thought that that was a crime. He didn't steal anything from anybody. He invented this wallet called Samurai, and they went after him. Keone Rodriguez, after co-creating the Bitcoin privacy wallet Samurai, was arrested, charged with a bunch of computer-related felonies, and sentenced to 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. Now, he pleaded guilty. He pleaded guilty, thus saving the government the time and the expense of going through a long trial. And what did he get for it? Nothing. Literally nothing. 5 years and a $250,000 fine is literally the maximum sentence that the judge was allowed to hand down. And that's what happened. 5 years. Now, we had a chance to speak for a few minutes before we started recording the show. And Keone told me that he's going to a minimum security work camp. But then that leads me to ask the rhetorical question of the Justice Department. If Keone Rodriguez is not dangerous, if his crime wasn't so severe that society needs to be protected from him, then why is he going to prison at all? I don't feel like I need to be protected from somebody who just invents a Bitcoin privacy wallet. And I don't know why anybody else would need to be protected either. Keone Rodriguez, thanks for joining us. And as I said before we started, I'm so sorry that this happened to you. I wish it hadn't.
Thank you very much, John. I'm very happy to be with you today.
Thank you. So let's start at the beginning. How did this originate? You have a mind for tech. You recognize the need for this product. And indeed, you're not the only person who's created a Bitcoin privacy wallet. Then what happened?
Yeah, so I got into Bitcoin relatively early, around 2012. And the reason it caught my attention so rapturously is because I saw the potential for a digital currency that could separate money from state and could be censorship resistant. It was the reason I got into gold and silver as a younger person. And when I discovered Bitcoin, I said, oh, wow, this is like a digital version of gold or silver. But there was one fatal problem with Bitcoin. It's completely open and transparent and public. So anybody with an internet connection can log on to a website and see every transaction that's occurring in real time and has ever occurred. This can become a real problem for censorship resistance. So I identified the need for basic financial privacy within Bitcoin. And together with my friend and co-founder, we built Samurai Wallet in 2015.
Why did the government object to that? That seems like a public service to me.
You would think so. The government was silent for 10 years. We built this in 2015, and it wasn't until 2024 when a pre-dawn FBI raid was conducted on my premises with 50 armed FBI agents, drones, armored vehicles, guns drawn, you know, the whole nine yards, that I had any indication that there was a problem with what I was doing. The government claims that just by creating this software, knowing that it was possible for criminals to use the software, made me guilty for the crimes of those criminals.
That's absurd. I mean, you can say that about anybody. You can say that about the inventor of Signal or Telegram.
Correct.
Where were you charged and tried?
Great question. I was charged in the Southern District of New York.
Okay, that's why I wanted to ask. You don't live in the Southern District of New York, do you?
No,
you live in the Western District of Pennsylvania.
That's correct.
And that is called...
I haven't been to the Southern District of New York.
That is called venue shopping. This is something that the Justice Department does where it will try to charge you in the district where you are most likely to be convicted and most likely to receive a severe sentence. So how did they tie Samurai with the Southern District of New York, which is in Manhattan?
Right. So the way they got their jurisdiction, I later learned through the indictment, is they sent some poor schlub FBI agent out into the streets of Manhattan with a cell phone in his hand, used the app that I created, which was a mobile application, and sent Bitcoin through that application on the streets of Manhattan. And that, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan, was enough for jurisdiction in the case.
Ladies and gentlemen, be warned. This is one of the Justice Department's dirty tricks. This is exactly what they do. Venue shopping is one thing. Charge stacking is another, where they will charge you with 5, 10, 20 felonies. They'll wait until you go bankrupt. And then they say, okay, we'll drop all but one or two if you take a guilty plea. Was that a part of the calculation here in your case?
No, they stuck with the two charges that they originally started with. So I was charged with two crimes. One, conspiracy to commit money laundering. You know, they love a conspiracy charge, the government.
They love a conspiracy charge, but there has to be somebody that you conspire with.
Correct. Their theory on this is fun. You'll like this. But the second charge is conspiracy to operate a money service business without a license. These are the two charges. So I learned these charges while I'm locked up in the jail. The public defender reads them to me. And in my head, I'm thinking, oh, there must be a mistake, right? They just don't understand how it works. Because I had always thought that in order to be a money transmitter, to transmit money on behalf of someone, or to even indeed launder money on behalf of someone, you actually had to have the money. you actually had to have it in your possession and control in order to transmit it. And that simple fact was not the case with Samurai Wallet. The whole point of the software was that the user of the software was always in complete control of their funds. They never gave up custody to a third party, myself included. So I was still naive at that time, thinking that the Justice Department must have made a mistake. They must not have understood how the software worked. I came to find out they knew exactly how the software worked, and they didn't actually care, right? Their theory of the case was, I conspired broadly with my users without actually communicating with them, but just by creating the software. By creating the software, that was the object of the conspiracy, because in their view, there was no other reason to create privacy software other than to launder illicit finance, illicit money through it. That was their theory.
That sounds like an incredibly dangerous theory if you're taking into account civil liberties. Like I said a minute ago, then how is it not a crime, a federal crime, to use Signal or WhatsApp or Viber or any app that can be encrypted?
Absolutely. This was the first time that the government had come after a software developer like myself for explicitly because of the actions of the end user, right? They didn't even say that I had knowledge of a specific criminal act, which is another thing you would expect for a conspiracy to commit money laundering. They just say, I knew it was possible that criminals could use the software I created. Well, of course I knew it was possible. Like you just said, criminals use Signal, criminals use VPNs, criminals use the internet. It's of course possible.
Incredible. What was the nature of your defense? And the reason I ask is this: when I was charged, I was initially charged with five felonies. They had to drop four of them because I hadn't committed them. But their theory was novel. And in the end, it just didn't hold water. So what was the nature of your defense? It must have been that you couldn't have committed conspiracy because there was nobody to conspire with, and you have to have two people conspiring to withstand a motion to dismiss. How did they survive the motion to dismiss?
Yeah, great. I love that question. So yeah, our defense was kind of twofold. And by the time we got to our motion to dismiss, we were about a year into the pretrial phase. So the first part of our defense was that according to the regulator in charge of money transmission and illicit finance, that regulator is called FinCEN, Financial Crime Enforcement Network. According to FinCEN in 2013 and again reiterated in 2019, they were explicitly clear. In order to be a money transmitter, you had to take custody of the funds. You know, again, pretty concise language from a regulator, refreshingly so, in fact, that you can't transmit something you don't have control of. So we used that guidance from the regulator in how we built our software and how we operated it. So there was a due process issue here. Right. The government now has this new novel theory that we could have had no way of knowing based on the existing guidance. So that was one part of the theory that tied into the second charge of conspiracy to commit money laundering, because the government's theory, again, was that we were a financial institution. And as a financial institution, we had a duty under the Bank Secrecy Act to prevent money laundering by taking customer information, KYC and AML information. Our defense against that tied into the fact, well, we weren't a financial institution. Clearly, we were a piece of software. The third part of the defense was just generally against the conspiracy charges in general. We found several pieces of Supreme Court precedent saying just mere knowledge of a crime is not enough to join the conspiracy, right? There was a case in 1940 where a sugar distributor got charged with a conspiracy charge because he sold sugar to a bootlegger who was going to create illicit alcohol. Alcohol is illegal at this time, of course. And it got to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court said, no, he wasn't a part of the actual crime of creating alcohol, even though he sold it to them. That doesn't make him part of the conspiracy. He needs to be actually involved in the crime. We found another one from the 90s, a grow light operator who creates grow lights for, you know, tomatoes, got a conspiracy charge because he sold his grow lights to a marijuana grower. And he even advertised these grow lights in High Times magazine, which is a marijuana enthusiast magazine. He even joked with the person saying, I don't want to know what you're going to do with these grow lights. He was charged on conspiracy. Government got their conviction at trial, and at appeal, it was thrown out because, again, the court recognized that just mere knowledge of the crime isn't enough to join the conspiracy. So we had a pretty compelling motion to dismiss. And then there was quite a bombshell in our case. For some reason, my lawyer, and thank God he did this, my lawyer asked the government if they ever had any communications with FinCEN, the regulator, about me or Samurai Wallet. And if they had, to please give over any of that evidence. It turns out that the government had had a conversation with FinCEN, and they kept it hidden for over a year. This was exculpatory information that they did not hand over to us during the discovery process. So when they sent it over a year into pretrial, we find out that the government went to FinCEN and asked FinCEN if we were supposed to get a money transmission license from them. FinCEN said no. FinCEN said, under our guidance, we don't consider them a money transmitter because they don't ever take anyone's money. The government then indicted us, partly due to not having a license from a regulator who wouldn't have given us a license because we didn't need one, and money laundering. And then they hid that fact for over a year. So, you know, we were pretty unhappy about that.
That seems like an issue ripe for appeal.
Yeah. Yeah.
The problem is, I'm sure your attorney said this because I talked about this too. The problem is you have to file your appeal post-conviction.
Exactly.
You can't just freeze things until the appeal is heard.
So we find this out. It's now time to submit our motion to dismiss and any other pretrial motions. We're at the deadline. Mm-hmm. So we write a motion to the judge. We say, Judge, there is a Brady violation here. Mm-hmm. We want more information as to who decided not to share this information and if there's any more information that they haven't shared. In addition to that motion, we filed a motion on our motion to dismiss, as I just described it. And then we filed a very simple motion to allow amicus briefs in the court.
Certainly.
Pretty standard thing, especially for a technology that the judge almost certainly doesn't understand. 2 days before we're set to go and argue these motions, the judge changes in our trial.
What?
We have a, yeah, yes.
I've never heard of that happening.
All of a sudden. Very rare thing to happen. And it's not like the old judge got sick. He was still hearing other cases. He was still in the courtroom. We just get notification that we have a new judge. And when your lawyer calls you and he has the demeanor of a person, you know, calling to say that your grandmother has passed away, that's not a good sign. And he goes, we got Judge Cote, and that's not good for us. And, you know, he told me that she was a former prosecutor, but not just any prosecutor, the head prosecutor of the criminal division at the SDNY. She has a reputation for maximum sentences. Certainly, if you don't take a deal and go to trial, you get the trial penalty. You know, she'll go full on all the way. And he told me straight up, he goes, this is going to be a tough one now. You know, this is going to be a tough one. It's unlikely that we're going to be able to do the advice of counsel defense with her. It's unlikely that we're going to be able to even mention FinCEN to the jury. So this is not great. But you know, you work with the cards that you're handed.
That's right.
And we had to go argue our motions. Important time, motion to dismiss, and the Brady violation and the amicus briefs. We get in, we sit down, she comes out, she says, "I've read your motions, I deny them all." And that was it. There was no opinion, written or verbal. It was just a denial. And at that point, that's when I knew this isn't a fight that's going to be fair. This is a fight that I am going to lose. And the downside of losing this fight is 25 years federal prison.
Yeah. Before I ask you about an article that appeared about you in Reason Magazine, I want to give a word from our sponsors. When I was a kid, every Christmas morning, my parents would sneak a little one ounce silver bar into my stocking. There was no explanation, no big speech. They would put it in there with a candy bar and an orange and a lottery ticket and a couple of other things. At the time, I didn't think much of it. I enjoyed it. And I held on to those little silver bars, all of them. I have about 20 or 22 now tucked away in a safe. When my kids were born, I kept that tradition alive every Christmas. I would go to a store in a coin shop in Vienna, Virginia. I would drop a silver bar into the kids' stockings from that place. And then while I was there, I would pick up a 10-ounce silver bar for myself. I also have those sitting in my safe. I've always liked the idea of giving them something that holds its value, something that they can actually touch, something that they can keep. It might sound old-fashioned, but after working in the intelligence world and seeing how fast things can change, usually not for the better, I've come to value some of the simple things that don't. Paper wealth can vanish, promises can break, but an ounce of silver or an ounce of gold is still an ounce, no matter what the headlines happen to say. That's why I was drawn to this new free report. It's called The Legacy Wealth Protection Blueprint, and it lays out how families are using gold IRAs to build real generational wealth, not just for the next market cycle, but for their kids, for their grandkids, and even beyond that. If you're like me, you want to give your family more than just money. You want to give them stability and resilience, a fighting chance to stay free and independent, no matter what happens in Washington or on Wall Street. If that sounds like something worth reading to you, click the link that's in the show notes below. There's no charge, there's no pressure. It's just information that I think more people need to see. So you can click that link or you can go to www.johnlovesgold.com. Keone, we're speaking with Keone Rodriguez, the co-founder of Samurai Wallet, who I'm just so sad to say is on his way to an utterly and completely undeserved five-year sentence in prison. There was an article about you in Reason Magazine. I'm going to pull it up here. And Reason, of course, is the magazine of the libertarian movement here in Washington. I sometimes write for Reason Magazine, and I know a lot of the men and women who work there and who write. They're very serious people, and they only write about serious issues. This was a feature story about you that came out about a month ago on November the 7th, saying Trump vowed to stop crypto crackdowns. Samurai Wallet proves he hasn't. And it says here specifically, I want to read this part. Samurai Wallet did not perpetrate financial crimes. It did not ransom data for Bitcoin or steal any digital assets. Rodriguez and his team wrote code, that First Amendment protected activity we learned to cherish after the crypto wars in the 1990s. Their service obfuscated users' Bitcoin transaction histories, making it harder for observers on a public blockchain to trace funds after they had passed through the tool. In the Justice Department's view, that now constitutes money laundering and a failure to register as a money transmitter, even though Samurai never held custody of Bitcoin, making the entire money transmitting charge odd in the first place. I want to add one thing. It says here also that, like I did, you wrote a letter to the judge seeking leniency, saying that you should have obtained a license for the business. Now, that was the crux of the government's case, that you were unlicensed. But then the judge wrote back saying, you chose to use your considerable talents to make it harder to recoup those stolen funds, and just dismissing your apology when it was the apology that was the very crux of the case. Tell me that that is going to help you on appeal. Because, I'm not a lawyer, I admit, but to me, it looks like the judge didn't understand the case.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when I was sitting there being sentenced by her, all I could think of in my head was, actually, thank goodness I took this deal, because I was going to be railroaded in that trial. She didn't understand the case. She was furious with me in my letter because she wanted me to admit and say sorry for crimes that I never admitted to. She wanted me to admit to the crime of money laundering, which I specifically would not plead to. And that's the crime and the charge that they dropped. But because I didn't, admit to this crime, she was spitting venom at me. I mean, it was a very uncomfortable proceeding.
Awful.
And I, you know, as soon as she started speaking, I was like, oh, she's going to go the full 5 years and she's going to go the full $250,000. This woman would have put me away for life if she had that ability. That's, I truly feel that.
You know, I have to ask you first about the fine. I faced a fine of up to $250,000 and I wasn't fined a single dollar.
Yeah.
You defrauded nobody.
Right.
So why is there a fine? There's no restitution.
So I had to pay $6.4 million to the government as part of the plea deal.
What?
Right. So, yeah. So because the government claims that $280 million worth of illicit Bitcoin went through my software. That's what they claim. And they said, if you go to trial and lose, we're going to put that entire amount on you as a judgment, a money judgment of $287 million. They know that I never had $287 million because I never had any money that my users had. They always contained that money to themselves. So as part of the plea deal, they said, we will take $6.4 million as a substitute for the $287 million. And if you pay us this, we'll consider the $287 million satisfied. So we did it. Bill and I, you know, jointly were able to pay that amount. And that's it. That's all the money we had. And we weren't able to pay lawyers yet. Like, that's it. We're at zero. And as you know, after you plea, you go to the PSI. Right. And you sit with probation and they ask you a lot of questions.
It's an investigation done by the U.S. Marshals. They interview everybody back to your high school days and then they recommend how long the sentence should be. And of course, they're working for the Marshals. They're going to ask for the maximum.
They did it in my case. They said, judge, he should get 42 months. And they said, because they do like a mini audit on you, they see all your transactions and your net worth and what assets you have and what liabilities you have. And they said, judge, you should give him a fine of $20,000. Those were the recommendations of the marshals, right? Judge said 5 years, 60 months, $250,000 fine. As you said, there are no victims in this case. Mm-hmm. There's not one victim.
No.
So what, first, where's the $6.4 million? Who's that going to? Who's that? What restitution?
Straight
is
into
that?
The pockets of the Justice Department.
Right. And then a $250,000 fine on top of that. I mean, this whole thing has financially ruined me.
Of course.
And that's also goes into your consideration when you're just trying to decide, do I fight this or do I take a deal? Right. Because we hadn't even got to trial yet. And I'm $2.5 million in the hole, right? So trial is going to be even more expensive. And likelihood is we lose, then that means an appeal. And appeal is going to be another $5 million, maybe $8 million. And I'm going to have to wait anyway for that. So that's going to be several years. the numbers don't work. The numbers just don't work, and they make it so that it doesn't work. So you deal, you plea, and, you know, they can forget about you.
I'm assuming that they gave your partner the same royal treatment. Is that right?
Yeah. So Bill, he got 4 years, and I think she gave him 1 year less due to his age. He's 67. So maybe she felt 5 years was too much for him. And I'm happy that she did. You know, at least someone got a little tiny bit of leniency. And she gave him the same fine, $250,000 fine.
My attorneys negotiated something called an 11C1C plea, which means that I would plead guilty, but that my sentence as negotiated between the two sides was set in stone and the judge could not change it. So when we went in for sentencing, we had announced that I was going to change my plea because we had come to an agreement. And my agreement was for 30 months, of which I would do 23. And the judge said that she had been a judge, a federal judge, since 1986. And she had never seen an 11C1C plea. And she looked at me and she said, "I don't like it. I don't like it one bit. And if I could, I would give you 10 years in prison." So, I mean, again, they don't get promoted to the Court of Appeals by being lenient and cutting deals. They get promoted by being tough on crime. Nice system we have.
Except the real crime.
Except the real crime.
You're right. Actual murderers and violent criminals. That's not that.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure that if you had caused physical harm to someone, you would have gotten far more lenient treatment.
Yeah.
Without any question.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
President Trump has been like the crypto president, it seems. Previous presidents didn't understand it, or it wasn't quite mature enough yet to warrant their attention. Trump actually follows these crypto issues, and he has pardoned several high-profile people who had been convicted of crypto-related crimes. On his second day in office, he pardoned Ross Ulbricht, for example. I had just met with Ross Ulbricht's mother and sister, and I asked them, "Are you applying for a pardon?" They said yes. They weren't quite sure how to get to Trump, but they had applied, and they were just going from sort of interview to interview. They had some support at Fox News and a couple of the other places. And sure enough, on his second day in office, Trump pardoned Ross.
Yeah.
This Changpeng Zhao, CZ, the billionaire, the crypto billionaire, he pleaded guilty to money laundering, sentenced to 4 months. Billionaire or not, if your crime is so minor that you're sentenced to 4 months, then the four months should be home confinement, for heaven's sake. But anyway, Trump said that he didn't even know who Changpeng Zhao was, but he knew about this case and he issued a pardon. That's a long way of me asking you if you've considered the commutation process, the pardon process, and if you think you have a path to the president.
Yeah, so it's certainly been discussed and considered. We even think that there's a high likelihood of success if we're able to get in front of the president or in his inner circle.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things about Trump is that he understands a weaponized Department of Justice.
Yes, he does.
He's experienced it. And like I was telling you when we were off the air, it's so reassuring to speak to someone else who has been toe-to-toe with the Department of Justice. Because unless you have been fighting that fight, you really have no idea how screwed up it is. You're like a civilian in a war, right? You have no business being there. And you know what it's like. And the president knows what it's like. And the president specifically knows what the Southern District of New York is like.
Especially right? the Southern him. District. That's right.
Absolutely. They've targeted him and they've targeted his family. So I think love him, hate him, don't care about him, whatever. The guy knows injustice. He's seen it. And he knows deals. And he knows a raw deal when he sees a raw deal. And in this case, we've been given a raw deal. So I think that we do have a good shot if we have a path. I've talked also to Lynn Ulbricht, Ross's mom.
Oh, good.
She's been extremely supportive of our case. Ross has been extremely supportive of our case. And we're working with a lot of the people who worked with Lynn to get Ross to the president's attention.
Good.
So I think there's a good opportunity. There's a good shot. And we're certainly doing everything that we can.
Don't forsake the possibility of congressional support. Go to your elected officials and lobby for their support as well. That can go a long way.
Absolutely. I mean, it was amazing. Days after the indictment was unsealed and we were arrested, in a rare act of bipartisanship in the Senate, you had Senator Loomis out of Wyoming, I believe, and Senator Wyden, a Democrat, out of Oregon, I believe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they wrote a joint letter to Merrick Garland, who was the AG at the time, and said, this is not what Congress has intended through the Bank Secrecy Act. This type of prosecution is not what we think is just. You should not be going after software developers for money transmission. So, you know, we have some support in the Senate. We have Warren Davidson, who's a representative out of Ohio, who said specifically about our case, he said, it's like charging Microsoft because the drug cartels use Excel.
Exactly.
It doesn't make any sense. No. So you know, we have some support in Congress.
I don't mean to sound bitter, but if you had been a crackhead relative of President Biden, or if you had been a Chinese spy, or if you had been a crooked judge who sold children into bondage, two of whom committed suicide, by the way, then maybe you would have had a shot at some leniency. Yeah. But it's a nice system we've given ourselves, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Instead, I did what I thought was not only legal, but moral. And, you know, I was put through the ringer. Bill was put through the ringer. It's certainly a two-tiered justice system we have in this country.
It really is. It really is. Well, thank you for joining us. This was, I'm sorry we even had to do something like this, Keone. Keone Rodriguez is the co-creator, the co-founder of Samurai Wallet. And we were very, very happy to have him today. Thanks so much for being with us and very, very best of luck.
Thank you very much for having me, John.
Thank you.